The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained, now with a new and improved website. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And happy Thanksgiving, everybody. As we release this, it is Tuesday, November 22nd, a couple of days before Thanksgiving. Chances are you might be listening to this after that, actually on Thanksgiving and maybe after Thanksgiving. So if Thanksgiving is yet in your future, may you have a great one, assuming you're in the States. And if it's current, I hope you're having a good turkey day today. And if it's in the past, I hope you can look back with the fondest of memories. And we're very thankful because you have tuned in and we want to give you a treat and a feast, a Thanksgiving feast of content. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to start out with Magical Destinations of the Northeast, Sacred Sites, Occult Oddities, and Magical Monuments by Natalie Zaman. And then we're going to follow up with Ghostology, The Art of the Ghost Hunter by Stephen T. Parsons. Those are our two guests, Natalie and Stephen. I think that you will enjoy it. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. And thank you for taking some of your time to tune into the Paranormal Podcast. And we'll start off with Natalie. Our guest today is Natalie Zaman, and she has an interesting book out. It's called Magical Destinations of the Northeast, Sacred Sites, Occult Oddities, and Magical Monuments. And I think it is going to be a great program because she's certainly expert in this area. She's the co-author of the Graven Images Oracle Deck and the YA novels Sirens and Sirens Back in Faction and Fashion and Blonde Ops. Her work has appeared in Fate, Sage Woman, and New Witch magazines, and she writes the feature Wandering Witch for Witches and Pagans. You can visit her site at nataliezaman.com, and she has a collection of crafts, stories, ritual, and art for pagan families. Natalie, welcome to the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what makes a magical destination?
Oh, wow. I think there's lots of stuff that makes a place magical. I found that, I mean, and this is my personal opinion here, that some of the most interesting and the most moving sites are the ones where people bring their emotions to a place and kind of leave them there. Mm-hmm. And anytime I've visited a place like that, it's really, really, really been a profound experience. I'm one of those, like, kind of, I guess, like, the running joke among my friends is that I'm kind of psi dead. So it's like, if you go to, like, a haunted house with me, the ghosts see me and they're like, oh, Nat's here. We better go on vacation or something. So I never
really,
yes.
I say that I'm sensitive as a board. That's my catchphrase.
Yeah, they see me, they're like, nah, we better, let's just clear out of here for now. I've gone to places where there's supposedly hauntings, and people around me are getting tugged and pulled and poked and all sorts of stuff. And I'm like, really? I'm like, I miss all the good stuff. So, but in places like that, like I said, where people bring their feelings and their emotions, it's been an incredible experience for me, who really usually doesn't pick up on stuff like that. I can give you an example.
Sure.
One of the places. Okay, so I live in New Jersey. I've lived here all my life, and one of the places, even when I was a kid, and I guess I kind of date myself there, that we would go to, like, for school trips, was Ellis Island, right? Ellis Island, Statue
sure.
of Liberty. Yeah, right. And I never really, got to go on, I went to the Statue of Liberty, I guess, when I was, like, maybe 7 or 8 years old, and we never really went inside, but we walked around, and we took the boat right out there. But I didn't get to Ellis Island until, like, a few years ago. And when I'm telling you that when I walked in there, and it's a museum now, You know, it's the one side is of the buildings or a hospital, or were the hospital, where no one can go. They haven't really done anything. And there's a wonderful book of pictures of the place that that's just stunning because they've kind of left it as is. It's still kind of in a state of gentle decay. But in the Great Hall, that's a museum, and that's where the folks came in and got processed and whatnot. And I went there partly as research for the book, but also because my grandmother came in through Ellis Island, and I really wanted to see, you know, what she saw. And also there's a whole thing where you can, if you're doing ancestry research, you can go and, like use their computers there and look at like pictures of ships and manifests and all that other kind of good stuff.
Right.
But, and it's a museum. And to that end, it's been very much sanitized. Like the rooms where the examinations took place. Now there's all like, you know, wonderful like pictures and explanations and all that other kind of stuff. But when I went into the Great Hall and I'm also going to add that I went on the first boat so that, you know, on the Jersey side. So when we went there, there wasn't a lot of people there for Ellis Island. It's usually quite crowded. So that's like number one travel tip. Go someplace when, like for like this, when you can get there early and be as alone as you can.
Mm-hmm.
When I went into that Great Hall, I did not expect to feel things, and I absolutely did. You can feel the anticipation, the anxiety, the excitement. I mean, and I actually had physical sensations when I went in there, like heart flutterings and things like that, where I really did not expect to experience that. And later on in the day, I did get to go, and I got to see a picture of the boat that my grandmother came on. I got to see the manifest with her name on it. So it was a really moving experience for me personally. But that's the kind of place where people have brought their emotions, and they've left them there. And it's still there for you to experience. I think that really makes a magical place. That's one aspect that makes a magical place.
Specifically, when we talk about something like haunted places, there's a negative connotation. Like, this is where there's, you know, for example, for lack of a better phrase, insane asylums or hospitals or prisons or those kind of things. So I think when we think of that, leaving their emotions, it's necessarily always negative. Is that a misnomer? Is that kind of an unfair characterization?
I think so. I definitely. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't places that give off that kind of a feeling. But there are just as many that give off a very positive feeling as well. And another example of a place like that would be the Dog Chapel up in Vermont.
Hmm.
And again, it's one of those places where you really wouldn't expect to, you go there and you know what's there, you know, if you read about it and everything. But when you walk in, the experience can be very kind of almost jarring, and not in a bad way. My son and daughter and I drove up there with our dog, mind you. Okay. Probably, I guess it was like in February, March. There was still snow on the ground. A little bit of a backstory about the Dog Chapel. It's actually part of a complex called Dog Mountain. And that was the passion project of an artist named Stephen, and I really apologize. I'm going to butcher his last name because I'm not really sure how it's pronounced. I've never actually heard it pronounced to me, but it's like Hunicke, Huncke, and I might even be spelling it wrong. But even if you Google it, you'll find him. His art is very iconic. He does dogs and cats, mostly dogs, lots of like pet stuff, but mostly dogs. A lot of his work is based on his own black lab, who he was very attached to. And this Dog Mountain Complex was his passion project. He bought this plot of land. It had a chapel on it. And he ended up refitting it with stained glass windows with dogs in them. He made pews with dog ends on them. And it was a place for folks to go with their dogs. It's like one of those like free range dog parks. You don't have to have leashes for the dogs. There's like mountain paths and, you know, watering holes and all sorts of other wonderful things. There's also an art gallery of his work. And then there's this dog chapel. And it was my own story for that is kind of is a little bit interesting. When I was doing research for the book, I found the website for Dog Mountain, and like most places, I emailed and said, "Hey, you know, I'm writing this book. Can I, you know, maybe I can stop by, or you know, maybe any information? Can I send you what I've written? So make sure that everything is okay." And I actually mailed it to him, and I didn't know it, but he had passed away. And when we got to Dog Mountain, I still hadn't known that he had passed away. Like, I'd never heard back, and it didn't, you know, because it's supposedly open all the time. So I figured, okay, we're just going to go there and, you know, maybe we'll meet him or what. But when we got there, there was no one around, but the chapel was open. I believe it's always open. And we brought the dog with us. It was kind of just too snowy to go out into the mountain and let him like kind of run around without a leash. So we went into the chapel, and Brock, that's our dog, kind of walked up the front, like walked up the aisle and just laid down on the floor and put his head down. Cause you know, sometimes animals really get a sense of stuff that's going on. So when you walk into this dog chapel, I'm trying to think of a good way to describe it. There's just, it's lined with papers, just all sorts of fluttery papers, like the scales of a fish, really. And when you go up close, you'll see that all of them are notes from people who've had a pet that's passed on. And it's like little remembrances to them. And they're written on anything from like a torn out piece of notebook paper to something that's been like prepared beforehand. There are pictures, there's stuff written on napkins, and it's starting to creep up over the ceiling. So, I mean, firstly, you got all these people that have brought all this love with them to this place. And, you know, it's sad and it's bittersweet, but it's love all the same. Like, you would not feel badly walking in here, but you'd feel this really powerful, like, kind of passion. So we're walking around, and Brock's still just kind of hanging out at the top of the chapel. And in the corner, there was a memorial to him. And that's when I found out that he passed away, and so did his wife, who it was his, you know, it was their passion project. So it was kind of a revelation that he had passed on too. But it was, again, it was more like a bittersweet. It wasn't any kind of negative, like I'm going to hurt you or anything else. It was just like this like big, you know, kind of group hug that was going on in that chapel. And you could definitely feel it when you were in there.
One thing you have in this book that really looks interesting to me, and I've got to know more about this, and it looks like you have it in every section when you go through these different geographical areas, you have a section called Stop By for a Spell. What is Stop By for a Spell? That sounds kind of neat.
Yeah, I just, when I first proposed the book, actually it was supposed to be one book, all 50 states. I would do the esoteric qualities of like the state gem and tree and plant flower. It would be two sites, one state of the book, you know, two sacred sites, one natural, one man-made. But I really, really, really wanted to incorporate something from someone who lived there, or who, you know, who came from the state or who lived in the state for a while. Because it's, I mean, I love just wandering around. It's funny because you were saying expert. I'm like, yeah, I'm an expert wanderer and stumbler of
I think we all stumble more than we'd like to admit.
Yeah, if I'm an expert in anything, it's like stumbling into things and being a little bit lucky and then that kind of stuff. But it's like as much as I, you know, I research a place and get a feel for a place and feel at home in a place, I'm still in some ways an outsider, except in New Jersey, that I could tell you. But I really thought it was important to incorporate a local voice so that it could be shared with everyone. So that's what Stop By for a Spell is. Some of them are spells, some of them are rituals, some of them are memories. I'm really, really blessed that people were willing to talk to me and share their words.
Now, are you a witch? Is that accurate?
Here's the thing. Yes, you know what? I would call myself a witch. Yes. But I think when it comes to, specific religions, like say Wicca,
right,
and others, that I would draw the line there. I think which is far more broad. When you're talking about Wicca, it is a very disciplined religion. And I mean, there's a lot of openness to it. Don't get me wrong. We're not talking about like dogma and hierarchy and things like that. I have practiced that, and I was raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. The structure is there, which is a little more free. I always kind of like to say I do my own thing. Because I'm not really affiliated with any kind of group, although many, many, many of them have made me feel at home, and I have many friends. So yes, I would definitely call myself witch, but I wouldn't like. There's a differentiation between that and the religious practice.
And I have to ask this because I think there's so many differing viewpoints out there and not really understanding what's it all about. And I don't want to totally get sidetracked on this, but I think that it's a fair question to ask and maybe one that you'd actually appreciate.
Yeah.
There's many, when somebody says someone is a witch, you know, obviously over the years of reading books and watching TV shows and movies, we have a visual, I'm talking about the average person who's maybe not steeped in this stuff, says, oh, a witch. She stands around a cauldron and says incantations and has a strange brew and a big hat and all of the stereotypes. I mean, really, what does it mean to be a witch? When you say you're a witch, what does that mean in reality as opposed to all that stuff that we've been kind of jammed in our heads over our lifetimes?
Okay. For me, it means many different things. For one, it means freedom. And freedom to find the god or goddess, however you want to put it, divinity, because I believe that there's both, where you see it. It's not just in a church or in a temple. It's an appreciation of nature. It's a belief in magic. To me, spell work and prayer are pretty much the same thing. It's that kind of thing. There are stereotypes even with the stereotypes, I still have fun with them. I still like the hats and I still like the brews and I kind of like that fantastical aspect to it that exists. But in reality, folks who are witches are just regular folks, day-to-day people living day-to-day. They have regular lives. They go to regular jobs. They, you know, except in their hearts, there's magic there. And they believe that, you know, things can happen. But I think at the end of the day, we're all more alike than different. We just call things by different names. But to me, the word witch is kind of liberating. Like I said, especially coming from a Catholic background, and there's still many, many things that I hold dear in my Catholic background. That's my ancestry, and I honor my ancestors. And I also think that's a big part of witchery, if you want to call it that, too, is this appreciation for the past and where you've come from. But I don't think that's unique to witches or witchcraft. Does that kind of make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. I just want to get your perspective on that because when people hear somebody say, I'm a witch, then they kind of maybe assign labels that are not accurate. And I like to let people define that for themselves and explain where they're coming from so everybody will have a better understanding.
Oh, sure.
Now, this book is not a small book. I mean, you're talking about over 400 pages, so people should be ready if they're going to get this, that it's not like it's significant, and I mean that in a good way. Now, and you cover 13 different chapters here, 13 different areas of the Northeast. Which one's your favorite and why?
Oh, boy. How can I answer that without a
It's without like asking who's your favorite child, right?
I know, right? They ask me that all the time. I ended up getting like the ornaments for the tree with, firstborn mom's favorite, secondborn mom's favorite. They're all my favorite. They're awesome. I have different places that have really, really struck a chord with me in each area. I really, in all honesty, I'm not trying to pander here, but I really don't have a favorite state, a favorite area. One of the reasons that I even, I guess, like proposed this book in the first place was I feel like we're a very underappreciated country in terms of just not even just magical places, but places in general. We have so many things, so many wonderful places, so many wonderful people to see right here at home. It just, you know, I wanted to share as much as I could. And I know that, you know, you're right when you're saying that it was big. It is a big book. I still can't believe that I managed to squeeze it out, you know, with all the pages and everything. My editor had said when I first sent her the manuscript, "Ooh, look how big it is." And I was like, yeah, it is big. But as big as it is, I know I'm missing things. You know, I know things were left out. I know that there's stuff that I didn't come across, some things that I had to actually leave out, just because of, you know, valuable real estate. So I'm sorry if that was a little bit of an evasive answer, but I don't really have a favorite. I just have places that, you know, I'm like, oh yes, I must go back here, or, oh wow, this was a really, really, really cool experience.
Is it okay if we ask you about some of your favorites?
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. One of the places that I really enjoyed going to, and it was on one of the treks that I made to take pictures, because towards the end, we wanted to add some more, like some more photos to the book. And I had a lot of people that were really generous in sharing their pictures with me. But some of them I had to take myself. And there was one day where I was like, okay, I'm going to make a photo trip. So I drove from where I am about like 2.5 hours down to Delaware to take a picture of one of Peter Toth's Whispering Giants. And that's something that, and I know that there's either one or two in your state. You're from Ohio, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, so I think there's at least two, because I believe he's from Ohio, or he had settled in Ohio. Have you ever heard of Peter Toth?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. He's wonderful. I got to meet him in person earlier this year, because we were down in Florida and we went to his studio. What a fantastic guy. He's awesome. So he, one of his statues is in Delaware, and that was the one I included, but I also wanted to include where you could see all the others, because, you know, he has one of these statues in every state. So I went down there and I took a picture of his statue, and they're amazing to wherever you can find them. They're amazing to see. These are huge. Some of them are like 20, 30 feet tall, Indian heads. And it's the nation that is native to that state or that area. Sometimes it's carved out of native wood. And like I said, he's done one for each of the 50 states. I also believe he was in Canada and some other places too. So they're just everywhere. And by the way, the one from New Jersey is missing. Just so that you know.
Ooh.
Yeah, the one from New Jersey, it was in Atlantic City. Okay. And it went missing, so we don't know where it is. That's something that I have on my list of things to investigate, because I'd really, really, really like to know what happened to that statue, but it's like not extant anymore. So that one, yeah, that was special, going to see one of his statues. I've seen about four of them now. But then after I went there, I drove another, like, I guess it was like two and a half, three hours down to Maryland to this cemetery.
Right.
And it was, I'm going to have to look up the name of it, but in this cemetery, it's, you know, you have your graveyards that, you know, you have monuments that are special. But this particular one has a collection of sculptures by a man named Dionisio Rodriguez. And he worked in cement, and he would make cement that he would carve or shape the cement so that it looked like wood.
Mm-hmm.
And there are seven of, it's really cool. There are seven of these sculptures in this cemetery. It's the Cedar Hill Cemetery, over in Sweetland, Maryland, which is really, really close to Washington, D.C. So he has seven of these sculptures in this cemetery, and one of them is called the Annie Laurie Wishing Chair. And this, it's a stone chair, and there's two seats in it, and you're supposed to sit in it with your true love. And when you're sitting in it with your true love, you hold hands, and in front of you is this little poem. And if you recite this poem, then your relationship will be blessed by the fairies. It's a beautiful, you know, it's in an arbor. It's very romantic. Unfortunately, I was there by myself. So I sat in the chair and held my own hand and hoped for the best before driving across town to Washington, taking a picture of the house of the temple, jumping in my car and going back home. And then that was like the entire day. So that was a lot of fun. All three of those places were special, but I love that chair, and all of Peter Toth's statues are just incredible.
I have to ask you, because in some ways some people view it as the most mystic location in our country, our nation's capital, mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. Do you have a favorite site from that investigation?
Okay. I would call it a toss-up between the war memorials, especially the Korean and Vietnam War memorials, and the Museum of the American Indian on the outside of the museum. I mean, the inside is full of wonderful things, and it's very informative. But the outside is very, very interactive. And, you know, people like kind of pass it by, but there's a medicine wheel. If you go behind the nooks and crannies, there's a medicine wheel where you can sit and meditate. There's a full lunar calendar on the pavement outside, I forget which entrance it is, but it's outside one of the entrances. There's million-year-old stones. There's grandfather stones all planted around the outside of this building. So if you're there, you know, always do go in, but you really can have an amazing experience on the outside of the building too. Every square inch of that land is devoted. And it shows, but you just got to look for it. You got to be aware of it. I mean, there's signages all over the place, but you know, if you're like, you know, on like your tour to go to the museum, it's an easy thing to miss, you know, and the war memorials are just beautiful and striking. I love the Korean one because it's so lifelike, and you can really stare into the face of a soldier and come face to face with war and its consequences. And the Vietnam one is like a mirror. It's a beautiful experience just to stand in front of it. Very bittersweet, but you can kind of touch the past there literally and see yourself.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned. I never thought about that aspect of it from this standpoint. You know, and I don't know if this was intentional, but you think about it, and I don't want to get political here, but maybe
sure.
The mirror aspect was the idea of you're reflecting back on yourself, the American public who sent these people through your leaders to go into this war. And maybe that was part of it. I never thought about that aspect of it until you mentioned it.
Yep. Or your ancestors. You know, if you have someone who was in that conflict and passed, and you read their name and you touch their name, but when you look at it, you see yourself. It's a really highly polished mirror stone. It's a very moving and amazing experience, and one that's well worth the time to stop and think rather than just pass through.
Now, on a little lighter note, and again, I want to let people know we're talking about. I'm going to read off the states and the areas real here: Washington D.C., of course, the nation's capital; Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. So there's a lot here if you're from the Northeast or love the Northeast. But I have to ask you about this one.
Yes.
Sometimes there's two words that you don't necessarily associate with one another. Tell us about magical Pittsburgh.
Ooh, okay. Pittsburgh is such a cool city, you know, and sometimes like places just, I don't want to say it gets a bad rap, but I mean, like, it's
Cleveland. I mean, I'm from Cleveland, so, you know, the river was on fire almost 50 years ago, and we don't hear the end of it. So the point being, I'm not trying to hit on Pittsburgh, but you just don't associate the two.
Right. But the thing is, there's stuff hidden everywhere. And that was the thing that I really wanted to call attention to. And it's just a matter of knowing, like the clock that was Kaufman's clock. It was Kaufman's department store. Now it's Macy's.
Right.
But that clock is still there, and people make wishes under it. People have gotten engaged under it. That's the kind of place, again, it's where people have brought their emotions and left them there. and they're still there, and they're still in the streets of Pittsburgh. That house poem, that's the, I'm sorry, my memory, my mind is a bit of a colander, so sometimes the names kind of slip through my fingers, so I'm going to look it up, where it's a city of asylum, that's what it's called. They do a program for artists who would otherwise be oppressed in their home countries, and right. they host them there. The house still has the poem written on it. By the way, I believe if you go on Google Maps and put in the address on Sansonia Way and go to Street View, you can see it. You can still see the writing on the walls there. It's really, yeah, Google Maps is a wonderful tool. You can wander the streets around there and see all the wonderful sights, even if you couldn't be there in person, or at least plan it out ahead of time so that you know where you're going when you get there. And, of course, Andy Warhol's buried there, too.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
And there's a 24-hour cam on his grave. Is
oh,
that
I didn't
crazy
know that.
Or
that? That is pretty wild. You know, if you're an Andy Warhol fan, go back. I think it's on YouTube. I saw an interview, well, kind of an interview with him in the 60s on the old Merv Griffin show. And he had an actress or a model who was with him who was literally translating for him. Merv Griffin would ask the actress a question. I think the actress ended up passing away. I think she lived with him or something. And she would relate the questions to Warhol, just kind of a, you mentioned Warhol. So that made me think of one of the most bizarre interviews I ever saw in my life. And how weird am I watching old Merv Griffin shows? What can I tell you? I'm just,
I remember
guy.
Merv Griffin.
Yes, yes, yep. Yes. I have to ask you about your home state. When you did this, was there anything you didn't know about or surprised you? Because I find that sometimes, we learn about things in our own home area, even after years or decades of living in a place, and say, oh, I didn't know about that. Did you ever have that experience during the preparation of this section of the book?
The Aleister Crowley thing was a bit surprising. I would say that was surprising.
What was that?
Okay, so we know who Aleister Crowley. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Everybody,
wickedest,
I think,
man,
yes,
in the world. Magician,
666.
All that other kind of,
yeah.
Yep, all that kind of good stuff. Okay, so please keep in mind that this is theory. That's one thing I have to say, is that in doing the research for the book, I've come to the conclusion, which I reserve the right to change as more information comes to me, that history can be very relative. Every place I've gone, there's layers and layers and layers of stories attached to it. Which is the right one? Who knows? The important thing, I think, is to keep an open mind and know as many stories as you can. And the Aleister Crowley story is one Western New Jersey story. And as I have seen it, this is how it unfolds. So Aleister Crowley dies in England. He's cremated. His remains are given into his OTO successor, Carl Germer. Carl Germer has a house in Lebanon Township, New Jersey. It's called the White House because it's white. Doesn't look anything like the White House that we know, but it's just the White House. The Crowley's ashes are given into his care, and from what I understand, what was supposed to happen was whoever was the next successor would also get the ashes, and so on and so on and so on. But apparently, Germer did something he wasn't supposed to do. He took the ashes, and instead of just keeping them on the mantelpiece or wherever he was supposed to keep them, he buried them at the foot of this pine tree on his property. And then another story also that's kind of related is that he didn't bury them. His wife took the urn or whatever the ashes were in and smashed it at the base of the tree, scattering the ashes. Either way, they were lost. They weren't in their proper place to be passed on to the next person. If that story is true, then Aleister Crowley's remains, his last resting place, is New Jersey.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
That's
crazy.
That's pretty wild. That's pretty wild. I, in the words of Johnny Carson, I did not know that. Now, the visiting these sacred sites, I mean, I think there's kind of like what I said, there was a connotation of haunted places being negative, and you kind of explained how magical places can be actually very positive. What what does visiting one of these more positive places do for you? How does it make you feel? I mean, do they have healing powers mentally, physically, and spiritually? I mean, what does it do for you when you visit one of these magical places?
I always feel that it's very refreshing. I feel like I can put my burdens down there. Especially in and not exclusively in natural places. I always feel like I take something away, as well. And not just memories, but like a piece of the place that I can hold with me, and then want to share it. But it's always, it always seems to be very, very refreshing and revitalizing. I like being on the road. I like traveling. You know, always ready for another adventure or just to discover something new. And there's always something waiting around the corner. So it's for me, it's always, even when things kind of go wrong, sometimes it's always turns out to be a positive experience at the end of it. Once once you're on the other side. So yeah, no, they're very, these places are very uplifting, I find.
So now the most important question, where can people find the book and find more information about everything you do?
Oh, wow. Okay. So the book is available. It's available directly from the publisher, Llewellyn. It's on their website. It's also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at bookshops all over the place. A lot. I know there are places that carry them. And you can always ask for it. You can walk in and say, you know what? I would like a copy of Magical Destinations of the North. Of the Northeast by Natalie Zaman. That would be awesome. And you could also visit me on my website. It's nataliezaman.com. And one thing I'd like to point out about the website is there is a special page for the book. One of the things, like I said, the real estate was very valuable. So the bibliography that's printed in the book is abbreviated.
Okay.
The full is on my website. I think it's really important because what you're getting here are tidbits. It's bits and pieces. It's hopefully little snippets of inspiration. If you want to dig deeper, then go look at the resources. The links are live. Hopefully all of them work. I've been checking, but you never know. You could always miss one. But the links are live so you can read the blog posts, read the articles, and see more and find out more. Always find out more.
Well, certainly we found out more talking with Natalie Zaman today. And Natalie, it's been a lot of fun. I look forward to having you on future podcasts. And thank you for your time and all the best.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that was a lot of fun. She's a very vibrant person, great personality, and a lot of great information. So we'll have to have Natalie back on the show. Next up, right after this, we're going to have Stephen T. Parsons talking about ghostology, the art of the ghost hunter. Stay tuned. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Now, for the last few weeks, I've been telling you about Gaia. I instantly became a member when I learned of it this last spring, and now there are even more reasons to join. Now, you know those big movie streaming services that are all the rage? Well, Gaia is that, but specifically for people like us and the topics we love. You can explore life's biggest mysteries from specialists in metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. On Gaia's exclusive programs, you'll find hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and of course, George Norrie. Now, I was telling you there were more reasons to join, and there's two big reasons right now you should join. Number one, they have a brand new website that has taken everything they do to the next level. When you log on to Gaia, whether you're an existing member who's visiting this new website for the first time or a brand new member, they'll present you with some really cool graphics and some visual representations of your interest. You do about 20-second survey there saying, this is what I like, this is what I gravitate towards, whether it's metaphysics, the afterlife, UFOs, whatever it might be. And then basically the website becomes a personalized directory of Gaia content that you'll love. And not only do you get all this customization, now you can watch your shows with upgraded lightning-fast streaming. You can experience simplified navigation for easy discovery and bookmark your favorite moments and mind-blowing new ideas with Gaia's Community Hearts feature. Now, in addition to their great new website, you can find Gaia on all of your streaming devices, so the wisdom, information, and entertainment couldn't be easier to access. You'll find Gaia apps on Android, iOS, Apple TV, Chromecast, Roku, among many others. Basically, you're listening to me now, no problem. You can easily tune in to Gaia. Now, I told you there were two reasons to join now. First reason, upgraded website, not to mention all the great content. But now, the first month of your membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. So to mine the wisdom, be entertained and enlightened, go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. I'll spell that out for you. It's GAIA.com/Jim. To sign up for your first month, only 99 cents. Now, you probably have that in your pockets, maybe in your jacket, your purse. So what have you got to lose? Nothing. Everything to gain some great, great content. I know you'll enjoy it. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia. I think we have a fascinating program for you today. We're going to take a little bit different look at the idea of ghost hunting. And we have a great guest to do that. It's Stephen T. Parsons. We're going to talk about his recent book, Ghostology, The Art of the Ghost Hunter. So maybe take kind of a deep dive on this idea of ghost hunting, maybe a little bit deeper than maybe you see, for example, on some of the TV shows. And Stephen T. Parsons knows his stuff. He is an investigator and researcher of ghosts, hauntings, and related human experiences. He's the author of numerous published articles and works on ghosts, ghost hunting, and related subjects, cited and referenced in many more. In front of the camera, he is a presenter, and behind it, he's advisor on numerous paranormal documentary shows for the UK and overseas broadcast networks, including the Discovery Network, National Geographic, the BBC, ITV, Canadian, Japanese, and U.S. TV networks. And we're so glad to have him with us. He's also the co-host of the popular international weekly radio show, Ghost Chronicles International. Stephen T. Parsons, welcome to the program today.
Hi, please, Jim, call me Steve.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Steve, when we talk about ghost hunting, the concept of ghostology, it's not really, as I understand it, a how-to book. What is the concept of what you've tried to do here?
Well, it started off as a book that I said I didn't ever want to write because my own bookshelves are groaning under the weight of ghost hunting guidebooks, how to investigate the paranormal. And there have been some excellent ones and some not so good ones down the years, but there are hundreds and hundreds. Ghostology came about. It really developed from a set of course notes. For the last 10 years, I've been not teaching, but offering people the benefit of all of the mistakes that I've made whilst investigating the paranormal over the last 35 or so years, whilst at the same time being very cautious about explaining to people that this is not how you should do it. You need to find your own way. But here are some of the pitfalls that you might want to consider and some of the things that you might want to think about. And I realized whilst I was running a ghostology course actually in Boston, just outside Boston in the US a couple of years ago, that printing out the course notes, it looked like, in fact, that my co-host on Ghost Chronicles International, Ron, was complaining that I was using up all his printer ink and said, had I printed a book? And it got me thinking, actually, that I probably had. So I went away and turned the course notes for the ghostology course into a book for those who either couldn't do the course or just wanted to dip in and out of different sections. So it really is looking at the study of ghosts and the art of ghost hunting, and examines the techniques that are used from the very first steps and when the phone rings, when you make that first contact with the person who's had the experience, right the way through to the cool stuff with the gadgets and the technology, how we deal with that and how we should be dealing with that and some of the pitfalls that might come about from using technology. It looks and considers the spiritual aspects as well. In fact, it hopefully takes a broad review of the current scene in the 21st century ghost investigation.
We talk about 21st century ghost investigation, but I think my sense is some younger people might think, or maybe even some older people might think from the TV shows, that all this just started in the last 10 or 15 years. But really, how far does the concept in it maybe a different way, but the concept of paranormal investigation, how far does that go back?
Well, I would wager that that mankind has been experiencing the paranormal since we were living in caves. And the human personality, I don't think, really has changed from our earliest ancestral days. And I would wager that 10,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, where we start to have documented history, there were certainly people who would be interested and curious about the experiences that others were reporting, whether it was the shaman interacting with the ancestors, with the gods, and people being curious about that. We have accounts from China that date back to 3,000 years, where people are clearly talking about ghosts, what we would call the modern ghost. They're mentioned in the Bible in the form of spirits. And we have the first documented case, which takes place in early Greece. So I think as long as man has been, you know, once we climb down out of trees and exited the cave, we experienced things that we didn't understand and gave it a paranormal label, there would be people who would come along and try to explore that part of our human experience.
Now, in terms of ghosts, I think the simplistic view, kind of the view maybe we grew up with as kids, and when I first started looking into this and doing the programs, I thought, ghosts are the spirits of dead people. But it seems like it's probably a lot more complicated than that. What are your thoughts on what ghosts are, and are they just one thing, or are they many different things?
Well, we can't even agree. Dictionaries can't even agree on the definition of a ghost. If you look in dictionaries like the Oxford English Dictionary, the definition that they use does make that clear link between some aspect of survival of death. You know, it is the deceased or the spirit of the apparition of a deceased person returning to haunt the living. And that's been a traditional view of ghosts that we have lived with for 2,000 years, and one that we all understand. When we talk about ghosts, we all intrinsically sort of kind of know what we're all talking about. However, we don't really understand the mechanism, and without understanding the mechanisms, the mechanics of the experience, it becomes very, very difficult to define what a ghost is. We have parapsychologists who will tell us that it is a product of the mind, that it is a hallucination, that it is an exteriorization of some brain process. We have spiritualists and we have mediums who say, oh yes, it's the spirits of our recently departed loved ones who come back, and they like to check up on us, and they like to say hi and send their love. The truth is, we just simply don't know, and we could speculate fret about it, worry about it, but we're worrying about something that we just do not understand yet. What it is without question is that ghosts exist. They exist in the form of a human experience. People see ghosts. People have been seeing and reporting ghosts. But what is that experience? What does that experience mean? Is it what is the parapsychologist said? A hallucination, a figment of the imagination, a function of the brain that we don't yet fully understand? Is it the dead coming back? The truth is probably somewhere out there. And the word ghost is more like, I like to use the analogy, the word ghost is like the word car. There are lots of different makes and models and lots of different mechanisms for powering it. But we all understand basically what we're talking about when we refer to a car.
Now, let's say somebody's out there listening and they've watched TV shows. Maybe they've even done a bit of reading on the subject, and they say, you know, I think I want to become a paranormal investigator. How can they go beyond just getting the black shirts and, you know, posing for pictures and the kind of like the stereotypical stuff we see? What can they do to kind of take it to the next level and apply some critical thinking? How do you suggest one go about that if they're starting in this field?
Well, I think we all start the same way. We all start with that curiosity. We may have had our own experience. We may have listened to stories. We may have had friends, family members telling us their own experiences that have piqued our curiosity. And we want to explore that for ourselves. So we do, we don't necessarily all don the black shirts and the para ghost hunting uniforms and stalk our prey. But we do like to go to the places where people have had experiences and try and have that experience ourselves. Beyond that, there are some people who are content at that level, that they get what they seek. They have found, you know, they have set a level of proof that satisfies them, and then they go out and they look for things that reach that level, for example, with EVP research. There are some who use that as a stepping stone and think, well, I'm not satisfied with the answers. I'm not satisfied with what this device is telling me. I'm not satisfied with what I'm seeing for myself at the location. I want to study more. And there are organizations here in the UK. We have the Society for Psychical Research and its American counterpart, the American Society for Psychical Research. There are other organizations. And of course, there are libraries, bookstores, there is the internet. And I've always said that people should read as widely as possible and look at all sides of the debate. You might think of yourself as intrinsically a believer, in which case go and read all of the arguments against the existence of ghosts. If you are spiritual and that you are if you believe that ghosts are bunkum and don't exist, and it's a one-shot deal through life and there's no such thing as life after death and ghosts can't exist, then go and read some of the fantastic accounts and fascinating accounts of those who have explored the paranormal. Look at all sides of the debate and then reach your own conclusion. But there are some excellent resources, but equally we live in an age where information is very easy to obtain. And bad information is as easy to obtain and is as plausible as good information. So you have to set your own criteria for what you consider to be good information. Consult people who are also your friends, family, members of your own paranormal team. And sometimes, you know, if things are so incredibly good, you know, does that not ring any alarm bells? Can it really be that good? Can we really speak to the dead so simply with a $50 radio, for example?
And I do want to talk about ITC, for example, a little bit, because I find that fascinating. That's really an interesting area. Would you liken being a paranormal investigator, if you're doing it right, to being a sort of detective?
Yes, in some ways, but you are dealing first and foremost. One of the things that you have to be very mindful of when you're investigating people's experiences is that you're usually chasing the event. The event has taken place for the person who has had the experience. They have seen the ghost, they have seen the UFO, they have had their experience. And then you're coming along and trying to understand the nature of their experience through their own testimony, through perhaps they have some documentary evidence, recording, photographs, videotape, but you weren't there. And rather like a detective arriving at a crime scene where the crime has already taken place, you've got to try and piece things together to find a solution that is the most plausible answer to what has taken place. So in a lot of ways, it's like being a detective. We use the term ghost hunter almost as if, and this plays out in the media, this idea that ghosts are an external entity that require hunting. The very description of the word ghost hunter implies that you are hunting something. Well, you are hunting the truth, that's for certain. So being a detective is a large part of it. But you're also dealing at a very human, very basic level with people's beliefs, with people's they get a great deal of comfort, perhaps out of their interactions with the paranormal. They might be extremely disturbed and fearful of their interactions with the paranormal. So you have to bear a lot of that in mind. You can't just go in to satisfy your own aims and wishes.
when it comes to tools, what are the most important tools of, I guess, for the lack of a better phrase, the ghost hunter in your view?
Ears, definitely your ears. You have to listen and pay close attention to what somebody's saying. It's very, very easy. And you see it a great deal when you work with groups or you watch groups on television, on YouTube. When they are interviewing a witness, somebody who's had a paranormal experience, you can tell that they've already pre-decided what's taken place. They know what the person has experienced, or they think they do. And they're almost not listening to what is being said and to the account that they're being provided with. So a good set of ears is absolutely crucial. Beyond that, what you're being told will define what you then use during the whole investigation process. There is little point, for example, going in and recording EVPs when the only thing that's ever taken place in the location has been somebody has seen an apparition or an object has moved. Those events were never reported, so you're not really there to investigate something that never took place. You are there to try to understand the nature of a human experience. I remember several years ago being handed a CD, a ROM full of photographs, 3,000 photographs from a haunted castle here in the UK. And the group who handed them to me to have a look at said, these are really cool photographs, it's a really haunted location. Take a look at the photographs and see if you can see anything. We've highlighted some, but we'd like you to take a look. I said, okay, cool. What sort of things have taken place there? Oh, people have heard footsteps in the corridor there all the time. So they'd taken 3,000 photographs and not one single sound recorder had ever been employed in the building. So it's using the right tools. One of the things that used to be very routinely measured a long time ago, up to sort of 10 years ago, but it's fallen out of favor now, largely with investigators, is, for example, temperature. Temperature is a very interesting physical phenomena to observe, because we have, in psychical research, we have some excellent accounts of properly recorded temperature anomalies going back to the 1920s, the 1930s, documented in haunted locations and within the seance room, linked to coincidental reports of people having unusual experiences. And yet we now focus on EVP, we focus on full spectrum photography, rather than looking back through areas that have been productive, such as temperature. A measurement of temperature is now very much sort of sidelined.
And why do you think that is? Do you think that it's just not as sexy as some of the other high-tech methods?
Well, when we have when one of the TV ghost hunting shows gets us a thermometer that says it's a demon, then I think temperature will become sexy again. It's media driven. The other thing as well is, of course, because it's media driven, we live in an era of we want it instantly, we want it now, we want it large. We don't want to wait. When I started ghost hunting way back, there was no internet, there was no pressure on me as an investigator to do anything but investigate and give the results of my investigation to the person who had asked me to be there, the person who'd had the experience or the owner of the property. And I could take my time. Now there seems to be a rush to get your stuff onto social media the morning after your investigation, get your fantastic EVPs on, report back. And temperature isn't cool. It just isn't sexy. It's instant feedback from photography, from video, from EVP. If we look at the analogy with EMF, for example, it was only a few years ago that every group was using an EMF meter in the form of a ghost detector. And then when that got a bit passé, because it was clear that these meters were not detecting ghosts, people started to talk to their meters. We had the meters such as the K2, where they were asking the spirits to flash lights and to do other party tricks with meters. Then the spirit box revolution started with all of these devices where you could have instant two-way communication with the dead. But it wasn't just the dead. These were demonic dead. These were evil entities because the old-fashioned ghost, the white lady drifting harmlessly and silently down a corridor, it wasn't selling advertising space. It wasn't selling television programs. The media wants paramilitary. They want confrontation. They want demons. They want murderers. They want the evil. It's almost the classic Hollywood phantoms, specters, and demons manifesting on our television screens.
I guess a question when you talk about people rushing back to post results on social media and so forth to get feedback. I guess the question is, what should be the goal of a paranormal investigation? Should it be to give insight to homeowners or property owners, or should it be to post some cool pictures? Do you think that maybe folks have lost their way a little bit in this regard?
I don't think individually people have lost their way. I think part of the problem, it's a dual problem. People have always, as I said earlier, been interested in exploring the experiences of the paranormal, be they their own or others. However, modern ghost hunting has been largely cut adrift by modern parapsychology. In the early years of the sort of 20th century, the Society for Psychical Research and others worked very closely with the ghost hunting fraternity. And that applied both sides of the Atlantic. As parapsychology became more academic, more mainstream in its pursuits, and more fearful of crossing into the fringe areas of science, the areas of spontaneous phenomena, that's what they refer to as the ghosts and hauntings. They tended to distance themselves from these sort of cases, leaving the field to enthusiastic amateurs who largely were lacking in resources and lacking information and direction. Parapsychology and psychical research, whilst it has a long history going back to the way beyond the 1860s, you know, into the 16th century, there were psychical researchers, but mainstream sort of the middle of the 19th century. excuse me, the resources are not readily available. Most people don't realize that they can find 150 years of ghost hunting history and some really cool results. They don't know where to look. And this is because parapsychology, the Society for Psychical Research in the UK, the Parapsychological Association in America, and others don't share that resource effectively with the amateur, the lay investigating community. And so they're denied the resources. So it's little wonder that they turn to themselves and turn inwards to the only source of information that they have, which is the ghost hunting television shows and social media. Somebody comes along with a cool gadget that they show on YouTube or on a ghost hunting show. They talk about it on Facebook and on their social media channels. Other groups will try it too. They get similar results, which seem astounding and amazing. And that's the only resource that these people have got. So they end up being even further adrift from parapsychology and from academic or mainstream science support. And it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. What's really needed is for mainstream science, mainstream organizations such as the SPR, such as just the universities, to re-engage with these amateurs and to say, look, this is good science. This is what you need to be doing. This is what you could be doing in order to further your investigations, because we already know how to measure things. We know how to measure sound. We know how to measure light. We know how to take photography in visible light and in the invisible spectrum. We know how to measure all manner of things within the environment properly, and we have international standards that are laid down and that we can all understand. If your equipment is measuring to those standards, we can accept your results. But if you're devising a piece of equipment that on the basis of it's got three flashing lights and two flashing lights means it's paranormal and one flashing light means it's a demon, then we can't take what you're doing seriously. So it has to be a two-way street. The investigators have to seek the information out, and the mainstream science and academics and parapsychologists have to re-engage and be available to provide that information. And that is the only way I think that we can sidestep this social media revolution, where there is a frenetic desire to get your ace and amazing results online on Sunday morning before everybody else and get your cool EVPs up and your, you know, your red circle ghost photographs.
Now, electronic communication, whether we're talking about EVP or ITC, instrumental transcommunication, Frank's box and so forth, or radios, as you explained, Spearcom. What are your thoughts on these areas? Do you think that they're valid? Do you think some are valid? Maybe some not as far. Where do you come down on those questions?
I think we don't have an ability to answer the question, whether spirits can communicate electronically, we first of all have to deal with the question of do they exist, but let's just assume that there is something. The next question is, can they communicate by any means with the living, and is that means electronic? Now, we do have a lot of history that supports the idea that it is possible, to the point where I would say that there is a question, a valid question, that requires an answer. We have, you know, going back to the 1850s, an American spiritualist claimed to have devised a machine for communicating with spirits. Nikola Tesla also suggested radio could be used to communicate with the dead. This isn't a new phenomenon, this idea of using an electrical device to talk for the effect communications between the living and the dead. But we do have a lot of testimony that supports the premise that people, you know, have this experience. That in itself is sufficient to warrant a question being asked and an attempt at answering that question being made. Absolutely, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
I mean, that is very tantalizing, this idea that you could ask a quote ghost questions and get answers in real time. And the thing is, it's tantalizing and I want to believe in it, but it just seems, well, how do, you kind of have this audible pareidolia where, you know, you kind of hear what you want to hear. And I think that could be extended to some point with EVP. Now, I've had people share extremely dramatic EVP with me for my campfire show, but the question becomes is I don't really know the provenance of it, so I can't speak to it specifically. But I mean, particularly when I think of this idea of tuning between bands on radios and things, I would love to believe it, but again, this idea of audio pareidolia, kind of hearing what you want to hear, I think comes into play and may be the kind of Achilles heel of it, or one of them.
There are many Achilles heels to it, but there are also some supportive strands. I mean, we have work that's been conducted in EVP laboratories away from haunted houses by researchers who have tried to close some of close down some of the issues with EVP. This idea of radio communications, because we all know that the radio band, whilst there might not appear to be anything there, there actually is. There is still radio frequency energy available in that band between what we can pick up with our radio receiver. It's only the inability of our receiver to pick it up is the problem, not the fact that there's nothing there. So they've worked with Faraday cages, they've worked with shielding, they've worked with devices to try and shut down some of these problems, try to control the experiment better, and yet they have still managed to produce intriguing, sometimes baffling results. And that is a lot different than simply going into a haunted house with your $50 Radio Shack hack radio and saying, is there anybody there, and getting, you know, imagine that you hear the word demon or get out or some other you know, something else that you're wanting to hear. There are a lot of problems, but there are a lot of problems with every aspect of paranormal investigation. You know, we could argue that we, as I said before, we don't yet know what a ghost represents. We don't know whether we even survive death. There are many accounts that suggest we do, but there are equally a lot of accounts that suggest that we don't, and that the whole thing is bunkum. And this is a problem that we don't seem to be making very much progress with, because possibly, as I said before, mainstream science has distanced itself from these pursuits because it considers them fringe. And when you look at what's left, and science's justification for why they don't engage is just watch some of the ghost hunting television programs and look at the social media, and then ask yourself, well, what rational scientist would engage with this area of interest and exploration? There are very few. But that doesn't mean to say that there isn't something there that warrants an exploration, that warrants questions being asked, valid questions being asked.
I want to get your opinion on something that comes up all the time. We have a Facebook group, the Virtual Campfire, where people will post their photos and things. And one thing that we see, and we've seen in many different venues over the years, is the question of orbs. Now, I tend to be extremely skeptical of them, you know, photographic anomalies, dust particles, smudges on the lens, and so forth. But I have an open mind. Maybe I'm wrong. Where do you come down on the question of orbs?
I think you're absolutely right, not absolutely wrong. Orbs are replicable. The camera manufacturers include now, many of them include a page in the camera handbook that explain this phenomena. The fact that the camera is small and compact, the flash is close to the lens, light reflects off the object straight back down the camera. You can create orbs to order. I've demonstrated with an experiment that's included in Ghostology, Chapter 19, where using a three-dimensional stereo digital camera, we were able to show absolutely that orbs are a normal manifestation. The problem is people like to – when people go to a haunted location here in the UK, if I could just borrow one of our sort of famous stately homes, which has thousands of visitors every year people will go there, hundreds of thousands of photographs are taken, and people look at them and then they go away. But when ghost hunters go to a location, perhaps the same location, and they look at their photo, they will pore over a photograph. They will pixel peep. They will blow the image up to X100% on the screen and look for any anomaly on the screen, and as support of their own belief, their own desire to capture something unusual and paranormal. Now, almost every photograph you will find a artifact, a problem within the way that the software wrote the image, a smudge on the lens, a fly going past, a droplet of water, and they will seize upon this. Suffice to say that I'm with you in the camp of certainly when it comes to the photographic and video presentation of orbs or light anomalies, they are absolutely normal and mundane. However, there are instances such as Will-o'-the-Wisp, such as here where I live in Wales, part of the UK, the corpse candle, which the description of people experiencing the phenomena in that they see balls or bright areas of light moving, these predate photography by a long way and might be an entirely different phenomena with a similar presentation. And so I would be very dismissive of the photographic presentations that were given, but wouldn't dismiss the human account of people seeing areas of, you know, bright objects or moving lights.
Now, in closing, what are some parting words of wisdom that you would leave for people who really seriously say, you know, I know that sometimes the ghost shows can be over the top, but I want to do this seriously and I want to go about it seriously. And you gave some tips earlier, but what are some parting words for those kind of folks on how to get into this the right way and do research that contributes to the field?
Think very carefully about the sort of science that you did at high school and how you were taught to do science, in that you had to document all of the different stages of the experiment and how you reached a conclusion. The basic principles of science apply absolutely to the study of the paranormal. There can be no exceptions. Just because you're dealing with something that on the face of it seems extraordinary. Don't be beguiled by your own beliefs and your own expectations and your own desires. You're not there to satisfy your own needs. You are there to try, hopefully, to understand what's taken place. And also very much up your game, because if you want people to take your results seriously, if you want people to absolutely understand your extraordinary evidence, then if you capture it in the correct way, people are going to have a great deal of difficulty trying to be dismissive of what you're doing and the way you're doing it. There are standards that are set down for measuring everything, pretty much, governed and regulated by the International Standards Organization, the ISO, it's global. Every country in the world subscribes to it and all of these standards. So if you're going to measure stuff, if you're going to record stuff and document stuff, if you up your game, you're going to, if you do make an extraordinary capture, don't stick it on Facebook. Handle it properly. Deal with the evidence like a detective would, forensically, and give science a hard time.
Very good. Steve, where can people find your books and more information about all of your work?
Well, if they head to Amazon and type in Ghostology, The Art of the Ghost Hunter, and look for the book with the crazy green cover and the scary ghost, they can get the book from there. Alternatively, I have a website, which is theghosthunter, all one word, .webs.com. And then people can find links to the book and some of the other things that I've been involved with on that page.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the program, and continued success in all of your work.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that show as much as I did, and I hope that it was a veritable feast of paranormal content during this season of thanks. And I thank you for listening. I appreciate it so much. And hey, if you're a family gathering and topics turn to the ghostly and the unexpected, say, hey, folks, look at my phone. Look what I can listen to for free. You can share it with your friends and family. And maybe next year they'll be thanking you for turning them on to all the podcasts, the paranormal podcast, and, of course, the campfire. We thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you for being a part of what we do, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.